Time to welcome in one of my favorite morning show guests. It's the guy who stays young by getting out and playing young men's games. It's Andy Balock, the former UConn baseball coach who's still involved with baseball around the USA and around the world. At your advanced age, what keeps you busy these days besides breakfast at the Aero Diner?
Well, I mow and I throw. I mow seven lawns on my street, try to do one a day with a 22-inch power mower. Obviously, we got to walk behind it. And I get to throw batting practice at the practice sessions over at Eastern Connecticut. And in the summertime at the Futures League down in Dodge Stadium in Norwich. By the way, this will be my 25th summer at Dodge Stadium in Norwich.
So as the old article said, we can update the stat now. How many pitches have you thrown in your lifetime?
It was estimated by someone called me from California. They were doing an article, and they said, with all your places you've been and so forth, we've estimated now, this was a couple of years ago, you're about 2.6 million.
And how many more are left in that old right arm?
The arm doesn't hurt. The body gets tired, but the arm is fine.
It's amazing how you've been able to keep doing that. And that's maybe one of the reasons why on April 22nd at Duncan Park in Hartford, my guest, Andy Balock, was awarded the Crystal Award by the UConn Club. Andy, specifically, what is the Crystal Award?
Well, it's considered by the UConn Club their highest honorary award. And they don't issue it on an annual basis, just on occasion. And I was very fortunate to be selected for that honor.
Says the Crystal Award, bestowed on rare occasions to an individual who has made extraordinary contributions to the University of Connecticut and its athletic programs. While the awardee's support of the athletic programs is an important criteria, his or her contributions to the university as a whole is the distinguishing characteristics from the other UConn Club awards. So some of the people who've gotten it before Andy Balock got it, Gino Auriemma, President Phil Austin, Jim Calhoun, Dave Gavitt, Lou Perkins, Tom Ritter, Lou Rome, D. Rowe, Governor Rowland, and Mike Trangisi. So a pretty impressive list there. You get something crystal for this award?
It's a very nice award, with the name on it and so forth, and the Crystal Award. Something nice to have in the home.
Did you have a speaking program with this? Did you go up there and tell stories, which you do so well?
A few comments here and there, but pretty much what I did on the acceptance is I gave a chronology of where I came from growing up in New Britain and how step by step, after New Britain High School, my days at New Britain High School were pretty good. I was a senior. We won the state championship in football. We're undefeated. We played Miami Edison High School in the Orange Bowl in a postseason game. And then I was a catcher for Steve Dalkowski, who people in baseball consider the hardest throwing pitcher ever in baseball at that time. And so those two little notorieties, I guess when I stayed at home and commuted to go to Central Connecticut, I guess they thought they were getting, somebody that played on a state championship team and someone can catch pretty good. So I ended up having a pretty good career at Central Connecticut in two sports.
And if he had control, how far would he have gone?
To the top. He could bring it. And my index finger on my left hand is still sore.
When you throw a pitch, was you like smoke coming out of your catcher's mitt?
Pretty much. I remember one time that it hurt so badly. We didn't have padding or anything, and so I took a thin steak and put it inside for padding.
The only problem,
the blood was dripping down my arm, and Coach Bill Huber said, "It doesn't look nice. Take that out of there."
The blood from the steak, not it's blood from your
steak,
arm.
From the steak.
Yeah. So how far did he get? Did he get to the majors?
No. He did in spring training, though. He faced Ted Williams and a few other big-timers who stepped in and stepped out, and they didn't want to see too much over there because they didn't pretty much know where the ball was going to go.
Neither did he.
No, he didn't. But he could bring it. Now, he was also a quarterback in football and a point guard in basketball. He was athletic, and he wasn't a real big fella. 5'10", 5'11", maybe 175, 180.
So if he could throw the ball that hard, could he, launch the ball way down the field in football?
Uh, Well, we didn't throw deep in those days. And we didn't, in those days, it was a running game, Wayne.
Football 3 yards of cloud of dust.
That's basically what it was, yeah.
So they probably didn't have radar guns back in his day, but how hard do you think he threw?
They estimated about 110 because they took him down to Aberdeen. The day after he threw about 200 pitches, there was no such thing as a pitch count in those days. And it took him quite a while to throw it. They had some kind of a setup over there. And when they got it through there, it was 100 plus.
Well, they made a big deal a week or so ago when Aroldis Chapman, now with the Red Sox, threw one 104. And they said, that's the fastest pitch anybody's thrown in Major League Baseball this year. And you're saying Dalkowski 110, just to put that
that's
in perspective.
That's what they estimated.
Well, ballpark figure. And I do mean ballpark. So in this program for the Crystal Award presentation the UConn Club gave you last month, there's a picture here of six coaches at the old Memorial Stadium. Give a little play-by-play of who these six coaches are.
Sam Rutigliano, who later became the head coach of the Cleveland Browns. Dave Adolph, defensive coordinator for the San Diego Chargers. Lou Holtz, head coach of the Jets, Notre Dame, and elsewhere. Rick Ferrazzano became head coach at Navy and with the Detroit Lions. Dan Sakanovich, Buffalo Bills and Miami Dolphins, and myself.
And how many of those guys went to the NFL except one? Who was the one that didn't go to the NFL?
Me, but I did not want to leave UConn because I was coaching football and baseball, and I did not want to give up baseball.
Did you stay in touch with all those? You stay in touch with everybody, so you must have stayed in touch with all those guys after they went off to the other places, including the NFL. So what are you doing now? You, at this point in time, are still very actively involved with the UConn football program, as you are involved with the Director of UConn Football Alumni and Community Affairs.
Well, basically, when I did come back to football in 2003, we didn't have a real database on former players. And we did in baseball. And when I left baseball, I knew that Jim Penders, by the way, he's doing a wonderful job. I'm so proud of him. And by the way, side note here, I did pitch batting practice to his father in the 1964-65, and we went to the College World Series. Then I did pitch batting practice to current Jim Penders, the head coach right now. He was my captain in 1990 and my assistant. And now I'm throwing batting practice to his son over at Eastern Connecticut, Hank Penders. Three generations. I love that. But what was that question again, Wayne?
I don't remember either, but it had to do with what your title of Director of UConn Football Alumni is, and you stay in touch with all the old players.
Yes. Well, I did a lot of research and found addresses and so forth, and I have on my database right now approximately 1,400 names, including several still alive from the 1940s. And I had one occasion where one fella called and he said, it's my father's 100th birthday. Could he get a tour? I give tours, by the way. In fact, I got one at 10 o'clock this morning coming up. Could he get a tour of the facilities up there? I said, bring him up. He said, well, he needs a wheelchair. So I went and borrowed a wheelchair and put him in a whip them around the building and so forth. He said, this is the best birthday present I've ever gotten.
Is this just the football facility? Or now they've got such an amazing athletic complex out there off Jim Calhoun Way.
Well, if a tour consists of this, Bueno. So if you came up for a tour, I would take you through the football building, both floors, and I'll tell a story on all the pictures on the walls and all the past players and the All-Americans and so forth, because I pretty much know them all.
Bowl games?
Yes. And then we would continue there. We'd go over to the building that houses baseball, softball, men's and women's soccer, and women's lacrosse, and the batting cages and doors. And then we'd go out to Elliott Ballpark, and then over to the old hockey rink, which is now volleyball venue. And then we'd go into the new hockey rink. Then we'd stop by the new softball stadium. And then we'd
continue
NCAA
tournament-bound softball team.
Yes. And then we'd go across the street and into the basketball and towed around through there. So the tour takes 1.5 to 2 hours. And I did one yesterday, too.
Including the Worth Champion Center, where the practice facility are for men and women's basketball.
Yes.
That's a pretty impressive facility, too.
Very.
So you've got the list here today of all these former UConn football players that you've managed to stay in touch with, get in contact with. You got a couple of favorite ones over the years?
Tommy O'Neill. And he was a player for us in the 70s. I stay in touch with him, and we visit frequently. Another one was Johnny Salick, who recently passed away. It was another one from the 1970s. Rich Foy, was the superintendent of schools and principal of New London High School. I stay in touch with quite a few of them. And again, constantly over, I counted up, there are about 700 of the 1,400 have been back for individual tours throughout the years of the facilities. And it's not an imposition when I do that. I enjoy giving that tour. And I feel that it's a trust put in my hands over here, because I'm the only one who really knows the history over there. And I could tell a story on every picture on the wall. Like, we get up to the people that played in all-star games and who eventually went on to the NFL. I could tell a story there. But also there's one up there I can point out, Brian Herosian, 1972. I believe he led the nation in ERA with us, drafted by the Yankees, would sign with the Colts, ended up playing. Then they had the strike that year, so he went to Winnipeg, played up there, and eventually became, I believe, vice president of Amway Products. And he's still up there in Winnipeg.
You know, one guy that I always liked on UConn football and led the nation in rushing, so the guy was not chopped liver, was Donald Brown. What's Donald Brown doing these days? He was on a Super Bowl roster one year.
Donald Brown's out in California, but I got to tell you about Donald Brown. Yes, he was a first-round draft. Yes, he was a first-team All-American. Yes, he was a first-class individual. A very good student. So proud of him that we have a display in the building, a Donald Brown display, because he was something special. Yes.
As you should have a display. I mean, how many people would think that the University of Connecticut would have a guy who led the nation in rushing? He was that good. Now, my opinion is that they had a really good offensive line. That was a key factor. And I think that a lot of those really good teams, the Dan Orlovsky, the bowl-bound teams, they had good offensive lines. That's kind of where the program was built around. But he had a way of making something out of nothing. He'd go off to the right, nothing's there. He had the ability to make that quick cut and go back where the hole was, and that's where the yardage came from.
And he had the ability, too, once he was contacted, before going down, he would scratch and get an extra yard or two. Yes, yes, he was something special, and a special person.
Went on to play 7 or 8 years or so in the NFL, the great Donald Brown for the University of Connecticut. What is your take on the state of college sports right now and the changing landscape? Things are so different now than they were just a couple of years ago with both NIL and the transfer portal.
I'm glad I'm retired. And that's why a lot of coaches are retiring and leaving the coaching ranks. It's like the Wild West right now. But again, there'll have to be some kind of reins will have to be put on what's going on. It just kind of, to me, it looks like it's a little bit out of control, but we shall see.
Well, you look at the 2023 and 2024 UConn men's basketball national champions. Transfer portal played a big role in each of those. Look at Tristan Newton, just for starters, but there's other people you could bring up as well. But by the same token, sometimes you lose players at the transfer portal. You've got to recruit your own players now, as well as other players, including other teams that want to transfer to your school.
It's such a controversial thing that's going on right now, and I try to stay away from it because it's a real headache, Wino. You know, I'm used to the old days. You bring someone in as an 18-year-old freshman, train him up, get him in a study hall, make sure he knows how to organize his time and so forth, get his whole freshman year together, progress 4 or 5 years later, shake his hand at graduation. That's old school, and to me, that was most important. But now, you know, people are just coming and going, and some just for 1 year and they're out, and it's just mind-boggling right now. And again, I'm very, very happy I'm retired and do not have to deal with that.
Obviously, you're still actively involved with a lot of things UConn, including the football program, but you've also had a lot to do with the success recently of Eastern Connecticut State University. And I know you were bummed out when they did not get picked for the NCAA tournament field yesterday.
Well, it's part-time over there. I just come over to the practices, and Coach Odie, by the way, is doing a wonderful job over there. And very good coach, very knowledgeable, very organized. And just at practice sessions that I make my appearance over there and throw a little batting practice and just be around the players, being around the team. Game time, I sit up in the stands. On the away game, part of the thing is I don't travel. But so I'm just there for the practice sessions. But in the summertime, though, we have the Futures League down in Norwich. This will be my 25th summer, Wayno, at Dodge Stadium. I spent 3 summers with the AA Yankees as a BP guy. and 5 with the AA San Francisco Giants when we had Madison Bumgarner and those people, and then 10 with the Detroit Tigers when they were in the New York Penn League. And this will be my 6th summer now with the 5th summer with the Futures League. And what I do down there now is I sit out in the bullpen and all the home games, get the guys ready to go in. We usually have a dozen pitchers or so out there, work with guys one-on-one, you know, while the game is going on and so forth, and just enjoy it. But it's a long day. We have batting practice from 3:30 to 4:30, the other team 4:30 to 5:30, and then there's another hour until 6:30 till game time. And you get home about 10 o'clock at night. So it's a long day, but you're around people you want to be around.
And you love the game. Players. You love the game, too.
Yeah. But, you know, I was very fortunate to stay healthy all these years. You know, my 40 years of UConn baseball, 38 with football, the 18 with pro baseball. 3 times I coached Team USA. I was a pitching coach. In fact, I just made a list of one of the years, Wayno, some of the pitchers we had on that staff I had to deal with for 8 weeks. Jack McDowell, Kevin Brown, Michael Fetters, Richie Lewis, Eric Hansen, Brad Brink, Richie Scheid, all pitched in the major leagues. And they're thoroughbreds. And when you're around thoroughbreds for 8 weeks, they're a tough group to handle over there. And, but that was very, very good. And then you know, I also had an opportunity to coach in the Cape Cod League for 4 summers. I spent 5 summers up in Chatham, New Brunswick, Canada, up there developing baseball programs. I did coach the Dutch national team's baseball pitching staff for 1 summer out in Arizona. Did spend a tour down in the Caribbean helping myself and Coach Banks from Iowa. We got the best players from the islands down there to send them to a tournament over in Europe. And I've done a lot of major pitching clinics all over the United States. So staying healthy and having a very supportive family, especially Mama Bear. She put up with all of that. And again, those 2 things, support from the family and good health, was able to do all of that.
With all the baseball you played, did you play center field or were you all catcher all the time?
No, I was a catcher all the time. On occasion, probably in the Twilight League, I might have gotten in to throw an inning here or there, but that was behind the plate. No
That's
question.
The Willimantic Twilight League. Tell me who some of the guys you played with from that league down at Rec Park.
Jim Parmalee was our pitcher every game.
Didn't he pitch till he was like 70 or so?
Oh, he's still playing down in softball in the Cape Cod. Yeah. I saw him play a couple summers ago. He plays that short outfield. He can still swing the bat. He doesn't run fast, but he runs well. He was a very well-conditioned athlete, yes. And in fact, when I first came to UConn as a part-timer in 1963 to coach the freshman team, he was on a varsity at that time too. But Jim, and then Lefty Mila was our first baseman. He could hit, very good hit. Andy Manigio was our third baseman. And I remember we would all go over to the Rock Garden after the game, and then he'd go over to Tony's and buy a pizza. I said, "Why are you doing that?" He said, "My peace offering for coming home late." But we had great times over there at Recreation Park, and I did that for my first couple of summers, and then I just couldn't do it anymore because I got so involved with my job up at UConn.
You talked about Jim Pender's UConn baseball earlier this morning. What are your impressions of this year's UConn baseball team? They've won 20 the last 21 games.
Yeah, well, he started out. You remember this? We had a crummy winter. Even though he's got the AstroTurf field, it was tough getting outside.
We always have crummy winters.
Yeah, but then look who he was playing early, too. You know, out in California, we were playing the biggies. Hey, and also I watched Vanderbilt in Tennessee on TV the other night, and they happened to beat Vanderbilt on that trip. And but, you know, it's tough going at the beginning. But now, you know, they're in a groove and, you know, they're swinging the bats pretty well. And I am so proud of the job that he's doing. And his assistants are, you know, all my former players, too. And I'm very, very happy. Jimmy Penders is just, he's awesome. He's awesome. In fact, I already wrote it up. You know, I'm up there 87 years old this June, and I want him to do the eulogy when I'm going to St. Joseph's Church. I mean, that's what I think of Jimmy Penders.
You talked about the scoring lots of runs. In the last, like, 10 or so games, they've averaged something over 10 runs a game. I mean, they're hard to get out right now. Yep. And how does this UConn team stack up against other UConn teams of the past, both your teams and Jim Pender's teams?
Well, his teams, well, they're swinging the bats right now, too. big time. I remember putting Daniels is hitting the ball at about MacArthur, the big first baseman, the other day, back-to-back home runs. One of them was a granny. But they got the nice tools right now. That indoor facility with the five batting cages, they get an awful lot of practice work in there. And then the other nice thing about the AstroTurf, too, it could rain. As soon as the rain stops, you go on out and play. You don't have to pull the tarp. And those are laborious tasks that had to be done by the players. You know, that's what we do over at Eastern. You know, here comes the rain, bring out the tarp, take off the tarp. And, I mean, there's a lot of work involved there. And but Jimmy's doing a fantastic job, and his assistants are all UConn guys, too. And kept it in the family. I love it.
Do you think UConn will be able to expand the number of baseball scholarships the new rules allow? It's going to go from 11.7 to 34. Will UConn do that?
I have no idea where it's going to come from. I remember the scrappy days when we were operating with one.
Along the same lines, the roster size will shrink from 40 to 34. So they're going to be giving more scholarships but smaller roster size. Does that make sense to you?
Maybe that's the regulations they're putting in, but I don't know if everybody could live up to it. Where are the resources going to be coming from? That's a tough one, Wayno. That's a tough one to answer.
Talk about some of your former guys who went on to the major leagues. And geez, off the top of my head, I'm thinking of Charlie Nagy and Roberto Hernandez. You just showed me a picture signed by Roberto Hernandez. Tell me a story about him and his evolution from catching to pitching.
He came out of a prep school up in New Hampshire, and he was a pretty good athlete. He was football, baseball, basketball, and came in. He was a catcher. And I think I forgot where it was. We were someplace. We put him on the mound, and he threw pretty good heat over there. I said, not too bad. But we only had him for a year, and that was the year that I went away with Team USA, and he called up, and he said, I won't say which school, but it was down south. They offered me a scholarship. And at that time, you know, we had very little scholarship help, and he couldn't turn that down. And so that's why he left. But we stayed good friends. But when he was a freshman, every day he had to go to the Sugar Shack and get me a coffee. And he sent me an autographed photo with he in his major league uniform and said, "Coach, this is from Roberto over there. I know the Sugar Shack. I'm going." But, we had Charlie Nagy, Pete Walker, current pitching coach now for the Toronto Blue Jays. He's been there for a while. Jason Grabowski, several years in the big leagues. Jeff Pulcino with the Astros. Jesse Carlson with the Red Sox and Toronto. Let's see, who else in there? We had a pretty good handful of them over there. And then Jimmy just carried on. Jimmy's had a lot of them make it up, including Clercius right now with the Dodgers, who's getting some playing time in.
Kasparius, you mean?
Ben Kasparius? Kasparius.
Yeah. He just got a win in relief last week, went to like three or four innings, and I think he's 4-0 for the Dodgers. How about Pete Fatsy, former Husky, who's now the Red Sox hitting coach?
Yeah.
You got guys everywhere now.
He's a local guy. He's from up around Wilbraham, Mass. When he was in the Little League, Andy Young, who did a lot of work for us up at UConn, you know, with radio station and so forth, his friend was Peter's father, and they had the Little League banquet. They talked me into being the speaker at his Little League banquet. That's where my first connection with Peter Fatsy. And then he came, and he was a good player for Jimmy, and opened up. After his little career, he opened up a hitting emporium up in his home area, and it was doing such a good job, and that's how he finally broke in with professional baseball, and there he is.
Great stories with Coach Andy Balock of the University of Connecticut. And you're tied in with some basketball guys, too, including your regular meeting with some of the guys who played for D. Rowe back in the 70s.
Yes. At Panera Bread in Manchester, it's a couple-hour session with Jim Abramidis, Jeffrey Carr, Randy Levine, Dennis Long, and myself, and we just sit and have our coffee and donut and chat for about 2 hours, and just in general. And hey, the other thing that's happened now too is I'm not into the computers. I still don't have one. I tell all these guys, I'm in touch with 1,400 guys. I tell them, don't give me this email stuff. If you want to talk to me, call me on a phone. And I do the same. But a lot of these guys, they have one of them in particular puts together once a month about six to ten, and we get on and it. And my daughter Jennifer taught me how to set up the TV screen over there, and we have a chat session. But the communication
is this what we call in the recent times Zoom? Is that what you're talking about?
That's what it's called.
Yeah, okay. I just want to let people understand what you're talking about here. Okay.
That's it.
Yeah.
That's it.
Well, and speaking of that, speaking of D. Rowe, back during the pandemic, you know, while we still had D. around, and he started to go downhill a little bit. And what some of the former players, especially Doug Melody, who played for that 1970 team, D.'s first year at UConn, they set a regular series of Zoom calls up with people that D was close to. I was on the list, a lot of his former players, including some of the guys you just mentioned, and he'd do them almost every night with different groups of people who had similar things. So like Wayne and Joe D were there. And then when things warmed up a little bit, you had social distancing back then. This is like 3 or 4 years ago. And we'd have the driveway sessions out there at D. Rowe's house. And if it rained, you'd bring the thing inside the garage with the garage door open, but you'd be, you know, 10 feet apart and so forth. And we would just sit around and tell stories like you and I are telling stories this morning. And I think that was so valuable to D. Rowe, keeping his mind sharp and being able to communicate with some of his former players. And I don't remember if you were on those, but I'm guessing you were on more than one. You got a chance to talk to the coach via Zoom, right?
And also the driveway sessions, sat out there in the big circle, keeping the distance and so forth. By the way, during that pandemic, staying in touch with the alumni, I made over 900 phone calls during that period of time.
Alumni, football,
and baseball, some baseball alumni. Jimmy's doing a great job staying in touch with the baseball alumni, so I don't worry about that. They're covered. But I was worried about football because a lot wasn't being done. But over 900, but most of them were football guys and then a handful of baseball guys.
And obviously some basketball guys. You just talked about some of the guys from the 70s and so forth. And we off the air, we were talking about Wes Balasuchnya and Toby Kimball, two guys that I got to know very well thanks to my book that came out in 2005. But got memories of those guys. You saw Toby and Wes play.
Yes, in the old field house. In fact, I remember one incident when D was coaching, and when they went to the locker room at halftime, they went underneath the scoreboard. There was a doorway, and they took a left, and they were in the locker room. And the team came. I used to stand by the door and hold the door just to be part of it. But I remember the team came out, and D didn't come out because D threw a ball down to show them how to play defense, and he dove on it and hurt his shoulder. And he was still in the locker room being tended by the trainer.
I had not heard that story. I like that one.
That was
Andy.
A good one.
Were you at the, speaking of Doug Melody, were you at the legendary slowdown game in 1970 against Rhode Island?
35-31. I remember
32.
32. Bobby Stack only took one shot in that game.
Leading scorer on the team took one shot. He was a decoy the whole game.
And we didn't have that shot clock in those days, too. And Doug Melody, with the right hand, the left hand, he dribbled the ball. Oh, yes, I was there.
Yeah, he probably dribbled the ball like 39 of the 40 minutes or so, and they lost four of their top eight players for that game. Three got arrested, and I think later cleared, and the other was Tony Budzinski from Willimantic, who had a temperature of 104, the center, and it turns out the backup center, Phil Hoagland, had the big shot, broke a tie, driving layup. Probably an offensive foul, but they didn't have replay back then, and they won that game 35-32, but. Ron Rabala was a decoy. Well, Bob Stack was the decoy, and every time Ron Rabala would like a little backdoor cut, Doug Melody would find him, and that's how they got the offense. Halftime was 9-7 in favor of Rhode Island. I was at that game, too, and that was one of the most amazing games. Final game of the first season D. Rowe coached at the University of Connecticut. Let me go back to baseball. Andy, early this season, there was so much talk about torpedo bats, because the Yankees hit a zillion home runs off bad pitching, and people made a big deal about it. This isn't the first year for torpedo bats. Everybody made it sound like it's a brand new thing. It's not a brand new thing, is it?
The bat controversy is something. You know, people say to me, why in college? Why don't they play? Why do they use the aluminum? Why don't they get the wood? Well, let's go back to why not the wood. First of all, where are you going to get enough trees to make that many wooden bats? Then there are different grades of wooden bats. I remember one time when we were using wooden bats way back up in, you know, in the late 60s, early 70s. I remember one college locally over here, the president was very good friends with someone with the pro organization, and they were getting the quality Louisville Sluggers.
and we were getting the secondary bat. I mean, sort of, but the aluminum, they're all the same. They're all the same. That's one good thing about it. So that's number one. And number two, where in the world can you get enough wood to make enough bats to cover all your college players in America?
And bats break, so bats are expensive. You got to buy new bats. Aluminum bats, most of the time, don't break.
And they're pretty expensive, too.
But it's like a one-time purchase.
Yes.
For the most part. And also, multiple guys use the same aluminum bat. You remember Steve Krajewski from Rockville? He played at Eastern Connecticut. Great player.
Crash.
First baseman Crash played at Eastern like in the middle 70s or so. He was a wood bat guy. Everybody else on the team, both the years before and the years after, were using metal bats. He not only used a wooden bat because he liked the feel of the wooden bat, but he used one bat the entire season. Such a good hitter, he never broke the bat. Now, I remember back in your days coaching baseball at UConn, or maybe it was after that, but they went to a different kind of composite wooden bat. What was that? It was like a bomb bat or something like that?
It was the bomb bat, and it was an experimental thing, too. And we used them, but we only used them in practice. And basically, you get the good feel of hitting the ball in a sweet spot, and if you didn't, the bomb bat didn't break. So it was a practice thing. And then when you picked up the wooden bat, you know, you get that feel for hitting it on a sweet spot. So yeah, we went through that period there, and we had direct contact with the bomb bat company people, and they use us in an experimental area over there, and they brought, you know, a variety down, and we used them for a period of time.
But you couldn't use them in a real game?
No, I don't know if we could or not, but we didn't.
How does that compare to these torpedo bats?
I don't know. It's just sensational thing. It's just like, why do they cup the tip end of the baseball and cut it out of the bat and so forth? I don't know. I think it's just a talk thing.
How about these crazy sliding gloves they use now that extend your hand like a foot? That seems like cheating.
People don't slide anymore. We used to teach the bent leg slide, straight in bent leg slide, pop up, you know, when you pop up, the hook off the bent leg slide, the takeout off the bent leg slide, and not many people use a bent leg slide anymore. It's all diving and skidding in and with the glove on to get the extension. Well, it's just like, with that one knee catching. The catcher for the Red Sox, the other night in that extra innings, he was down on one knee. There was a runner on third base, and he couldn't reach a dirt ball. And the run scored to tie it up, and they went the next inning after that and lost. And a year ago, I counted five times he did the same thing with a runner on third base. And I totally decry that. I know they're trying to get the low strike call and so forth, but still, you lose mobility on a dirt ball. And most important thing is you got to be a good blocker to play that position. And then again, that's a controversial thing, but the analytics say, well, you get the low pitch. Well, I'd rather give up the low pitch here and there and save the run.
We haven't talked much about the Hartford Twilight League. You're involved in that as well. How so?
Well, the Greater Hartford Twilight League is a league that I played in many, many moons ago, as did Coach Bill Holowaty. Well, they were struggling with organization, and things were kind of falling apart with that league. And Coach Holowaty took over as the president. And using all his skills that he had as an athletic director and so forth over the years now, several years now, he really straightened it out. The league is in very good standing now. I think we have six or eight teams there. But there are no forfeitures. Things are in order. The department is very, very good by the players and coaches and so forth. And when he took over as president, he invited me to come along to be the vice president.
Good call.
So my job, basically, because my summer involvement with down at Norwich and so forth is kind of part-time, but I would travel around to see each team in the league play a game or two before the game. I would talk to the players in the dugout, and I would ask them the basic question, like the team from Meriden. I would say, fellas, why do you do this, what you're doing? First, you have to work your daily job, get out of work, hustle, drive through traffic to get maybe an away game in South Windsor, and it's a struggle. Why do you do that? You know why? Because you love the game, you love the camaraderie, and you love the competition. Do it as long as you possibly can. And then I'd say, and then look at me at my age. Why do I keep doing what I'm doing? Because I love it. Just like you love what you're doing right now, keep playing. Dan Truby, I guess, took my advice. He's still with Vernon. I think he's 42 years old right now, and he makes an all-star team every year. But Coach Holowaty did a wonderful job getting that league put together again. We have an annual golf day, which we do locally as a fundraiser and so forth. And we're in financially, you know, we're not in the hole. Things are run well. The teams are well uniformed. They're organized. There are no forfeitures. And again, I'm very, very happy with the job he's done with that. And I was very happy to be his assistant for these years.
Is that a just recreational league like the Willimantic Twilight League, or they actually use that for perhaps development of high school and or college players for their college years?
Oh, it's a mixture of mostly it's a lot of guys that played the game at college or whatever and are just want to keep playing the game. There are a few young ones in there involved, not too often. It's like Donahue over there, who played for us at Eastern over there. He gave up playing American Legion ball to play with the Vernon Orioles, just to be under the tutelage of a couple of the older players over there, which really helped him. But it's a mixture. But it's mostly guys who are getting up there in the years now.
You mentioned Bill Holowaty. Got to say a couple of things about him, including the process they're going through right now to rename or name the Eastern Baseball Field, that facility in Mansfield, after him. So your thoughts on what Coach Holowaty has given, not just to Eastern Connecticut State University, but to baseball in general, including outside of Connecticut?
Yeah, he's done a great job. He's been a great ambassador, and he served as the president of the American Baseball Coach Association at one time too, which is huge. You know, we have like 7,500 members of all levels, collegiate coaches, high school coaches, summer coaches, so forth, and you know, using his administrative skills. But he's done a heck of a job for the sport for a long period of time, and this recognition coming up over here, it's well deserved. And I'm looking forward to the day we do something over there, because I want to be right in the front row there to shake his hand.
Andy Balock has been involved with the University of Connecticut since 1964. How many presidents have you been affiliated with?
11 presidents, 9 athletic directors, and 14 football coaches. And, you know, in addition to that, Wayne, what do we have, 167 towns in the state of Connecticut, 169, whatever it is? I think I've spoken at a banquet at every single town in the state of Connecticut. And, you know, my asking price is really good. Chicken dinner, meet the fire chief, and thank you. But I just do it for just the sake of doing it, to meet people and just to spread the good word about the University of Connecticut.
And your asking price today was a firm handshake, and you got it already. Let me change gears a little bit, talking baseball. I always enjoy this talk, that back around 1990, I think it was, you actually helped teach umpires the business. And you not only have had several guys go on to the bigs, but guys like Jim Reynolds and Dan Isasogna have had some high-profile assignments, including the World Series, crew chief. How did that whole umpire school thing come about at UConn, and is it there anymore?
Well, no. We had a JV program, and we were very limited in scholarship with UConn baseball. But we had a JV program, which was really, really big. We get average players, and you start with about 20, 25 of them, maybe 3 or 4 could develop. I'll give you one good example. We had one fellow came in the fall, and we cut him. In the wintertime, he hung around in the batting cage, and we put him on the JV that spring. 3 years later, in 1985, he was the Big East Player of the Year and drafted by the Atlanta. So to run that program, we have to play a schedule. Now, to play a schedule, you have to pay umpires. So what I did is I went to a couple of umpiring sessions with a couple of major league guys that put on sessions and learned what I could. And then I started the program. I got 7 or 8, 10 guys in there. Nick Giaquinto was one of them, our old football guy. Billy Maver, our football captain at one time. Jimmy Reynolds, Dan Isasogna, Jay Moran, the mayor from Manchester, Connecticut. And what I did was we met a couple times a week during the winter and went over technique and so forth and rules. And they officiated the JV games. And we didn't travel. We invited other junior colleges to come to play us, prep schools and so forth, and they officiated all those games. And then those two guys took it very seriously and went on to, umpiring school and, of course, progressed to be crew chiefs in the big leagues. And Jimmy Reynolds is retired now. He had three concussions. He didn't want a fourth one. You know, and that happens. You see the foul tip and hitting the umpire and so forth. And so it was a little serious thing involved right there. But Danny is still going strong. And that's how that all originated. It was just out of a cost factor, but it turned out to be a pretty good thing. But it's not run anymore, no.
You got to be super proud anytime you see Dan now, Jim then, to see your guys out there behind home plate doing Major League Baseball. And know they started at the University of Connecticut. That's great.
Yep.
So that's a great little tidbit behind the scenes of UConn baseball. Now, when you were coaching baseball at UConn, you won the Big East Tournament Championship in 1990 and 1992. If you put one of those teams against this year's team, how do you think it would turn out?
I don't know. Baseball has changed so much. For example, there's so much micromanaging going on. Calling every pitch, you know, from the dugout and so forth. And I was old school. I didn't call pitches. I taught a system. First pitch, low, middle, away. And if a guy takes it, it's 0-1. If he hits it, he won't hit it out. He might get a single. But if it's 1-0, now you got to go back to low, middle. Now, if it's 0-1, you could go to either half of the plate. Two pitches, 2-0, low middle, 1-1, either half, 0-2, make them chase. You know, just teach a system. So, you know, I'm old school with that.
So what do they do now?
Now someone in the dugout is pushing a button, and the catcher and the pitcher in a lot of cases have this little wristband that tells them number one, it tells them what pitch, and the second number that comes up tells them where to try to locate it. And I I'm old school. I don't agree with it, but that's what everybody's doing. They're doing it in softball, too.
And fast pitch softball.
Micromanaging. Yeah. It's in all sports. Look at football. You know, you got someone up in the box, and you got half a dozen guys down on the sideline waving signals and so forth. There's a lot of micromanaging. And I wasn't a micromanager in either sport. And, by the way, I loved my years of coaching football, too. You know, I was the head freshman coach. We had our own games and so forth and regular schedule. And I enjoyed that very, very much. And I enjoyed my playing days in football because I got to play 3 years after college, too. So people always say, which sport do you prefer? I love them both. And that's why I stayed at UConn. I loved them both. I was able to be engaged in football and baseball for a long period of time.
Both being football and baseball. With Andy Balock in our final minutes here this morning with the former UConn baseball coach. Tell me about the student-athlete part of the equation, especially now with all the travel. There's so much more travel with all of the UConn teams than they had back in the days even when you were coaching and back when you were playing. How these kids keep up their academic work. Take, for example, the fact UConn softball was at Villanova for most of last week for the Big East tournament, which they eventually won, while the rest of their classmates are taking final exams. How do these student-athletes keep up with their studies? We just had Alex Caraban and Samson Johnson, cap and gown, graduate over the weekend. Somehow they do it.
Electronically. In my day, I mean, we did not have that luxury.
He's holding a smartphone up to the microphone. We can all see it. the tablets they have.
That's how a lot of
and they
is
and they bring well. Academic advisors along on these road trips, and they do have study halls, and they need help, they get help.
Yeah.
In fact, there's a lot more academic help now than they had back in the days when you were coaching.
Well, when I first came to UConn, Rick Prezzano told me, he said, the first charge is that we have an attrition rate, which is outrageous with freshmen. Keep them in school. And when I was at East Catholic High School, I taught a reading course, which entailed study skills and so forth. So I just brought that into UConn. So from Sunday night through Thursday night, from 7:30 to 10 o'clock for 20 years at Monteith Hall, I had all freshman football and baseball players. They came in at 7:15, 15 minutes early. They each got a piece of paper, 10 words, part of speech and meaning taken out of Reader's Digest word power to increase your vocabulary. 7:30 to 7:45, there was a study tip. Speed reading, note-taking, composition writing, time management, whatever. And then the rest of the time, get your work done. And I did that for 20 years and never missed a night. And when I stopped doing it, Mama Bear took over and did it for the next 10 years. And now we have a whole department that heads that up. But so many of those players come back and they say, if it weren't for that, I'd have flunked out of school. Thank you so much. One of them, he said, he swears by that program. He said, I wanted to go home at the first week of classes. I wanted no part of it, but I was encouraged to stay and so forth. And as a reward, these people keep coming back. And if you need something from one of them, you just, it's a phone call.
Great story. And by the way, I notice on your left hand there, you have a UConn ring. I need the story of what that ring is for.
That one, I think, is the 1990 Hooksie
Big East Championship.
Championship, yeah.
Where'd this Hooksie thing come from? That is the logo of UConn baseball.
Right. We always had that Hooksie. That was the UConn way back, the J.O. Christian's time. And then we didn't let it get out. Like people would say, well, we want to manufacture and make that hat. No, that's unique. It stays with UConn baseball. Now you can go to the bookstore and you get a Hooksie hat. But it just stayed on, and then Jimmy promotes it too, and it's just part of UConn baseball, the Hooksie.
And the Hooksie is big game tonight, 6:05 at Elliott Ballpark. They take on Northeastern, which has won 20 in a row, and UConn's won 20 of its last 21, and I'll bet you'll be there tonight, won't you?
I'll be there.
UConn, Andy Balog joining us this morning. Andy currently is the director of UConn Football Alumni and Community Affairs, but he's got his hands with a lot of the UConn athletes, former, future, current, and the like. Andy, I value your friendship. Thanks for coming in this morning. I love your stories.
And I love being with you, Wayne Norman.
14 WILI Willimantic and 95.3 FM.